Blog Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
Brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. Happy 407 Day. And for those of you that don't know or don't remember, 407 Day was kind of declared last year and they're repeating it this year. We're trying to encourage people to support the small local businesses here in Central Florida, in particular the restaurants and stuff like that. So please go out, buy something from a small business, eat something from a small business here in Central Florida, support the small businesses, help our economy get back on its feet. So, you know, whatever, if you have a favorite small business you want to share, you know, send a message to the G's Power Hour Facebook page. We'd like to know. We want to put it out there so everybody can know where to go and what, where to get the best local stuff. So we want to do that. Also, today is National Walking Day. So I'm going to post some articles about how to select a good pair of shoes because that's important, whether you're walking for exercise or just walking in general. You got to take care of those feet. So anyway, today we are getting an update from our favorite civil rights attorney to give us some insight into the Derek Chauvin trial. So good morning, Mr. Kevin Anderson. How are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you so much, and thank you for your return visit to our show and to give us the unique insight that is truly yours into what's going on with the trial. So I'm turning it over to you. Take it away.
All right. Well, we'll be collaborative on this. I'll just get it started because you're going to jump in at some point, I'm sure. All right. So a lot has happened since we last updated everyone. Particularly, there was an issue with one of the jurors that began the week with what's known as a Swartz hearing. And a Swartz hearing is a proceeding to determine whether there has been either juror misconduct or something which might influence the jury and cause a prejudicial impact on the decision-making process. The court ordered that proceeding not be recorded either by video or audio. So we don't know what took place as of now. I'm sure that's going to come out at some point, but the court did rule that there was insufficient evidence to sustain any type of objection or inquiry regarding misconduct or inappropriate prejudice regarding that particular juror. So that's something that's behind us now. With that being said, if you recall when the coverage began on the Chauvin trial, we called it. We stated that this case will come down to training and causation. Training and causation. And sure enough, the witnesses who have been brought forward by the prosecution have been essentially training witnesses, use of force witnesses, police practice witnesses, all from the department so far, who have given an opinion with respect to Mr. Chauvin's training history, the use of force policies in existence in Minneapolis, and whether or not in the judgment of some of the trainers and the police supervisors that what took place was appropriate and reasonable in terms of the use of force. So far, that's what we have actually been looking at. In addition, there was the emergency procedures type of witness that came in concerning the practices that were used on or not used by on Mr. Floyd when he was in distress. I believe one of the witnesses was a person, who was this individual? It was a person by the name of Mr. Yang. He was a crisis intervention training coordinator who gave testimony as to what should have taken place in this particular set of facts. Who followed him was a person by the name of, and this was an officer, Officer McKenzie, who is an EMT and assigned as a medical support coordinator, who gave some testimony concerning the types of medical maneuvers that the officers are trained to administer in situations where there might be some form of medical distress.
So I know there's been, I guess, a little bit of debate or a little bit of quirkiness in terms of, was the knee fully on the neck or was it on the shoulder, and how the training makes a difference in terms of how that, I guess, technique is applied. Plus, one of the things I want to get to that I thought was interesting is that most of the police that have been called, in a lot of cases you think that they're going to support their brother in blue, and that has just not been the case, especially when it comes to the technique you use, especially when one person says, we were in training about this very thing.
Yes, I believe Johnny Mercil, he was the lieutenant and the use of force instructor. He was brought in to testify after the chief. His testimony was that the knee or placement of the knee on the neck is not a neck restraint, and that it is not something that in his judgment, the way it was applied was consistent with reasonable use of force. He did talk about, though, the need for ground manipulation, which was interesting. I thought that the defense lawyer did a really credible job of cross-examining this witness by stating or asking him whether there would ever come a time where one would have to hold an individual on the ground while restrained by using mm-hmm. their body weight to do so. And this prosecution witness, he said, yes, there are times when that is appropriate. He also went on to give answers during cross-examination that there are instances where a detainee may be handcuffed and prone, and that person may still be held to the ground, where, for example, bystanders are causing an issue, or there may be some type of hazards, such as, for example, a person laying in the roadway who might otherwise be jeopardized by traffic, mm-hmm. where an individual is aggressive on the ground, or if a person is unconscious and may regain consciousness, who would then potentially be aggressive. He talked about partner safety. He talked about, crowd safety, where people might be throwing things or might be doing things that could cause the situation to get out of control. So I thought that quite a few things were extracted by the defense lawyer to neutralize that particular witness. There was one thing he said that got my attention. He used, and I'm talking about the defense lawyer Nelson, he used demonstrative evidence. And a part of that evidence was the videotape that he zeroed in on when the EMT took the pulse, the neck pulse from the carotid artery of Mr. Floyd. And he asked the use of force expert whether the neck pulse could be taken if Mr. Chauvin's knee was on Mr. Floyd's neck.
Mm-hmm.
And the witness said, basically, no. And upon further examination, he looked, and they had to agree that the knee was not on the neck at that point, and that it was close to the neck but across the back, which was, I thought, a point where objections were drawn from the prosecutor, a request for a sidebar conference was made that was promptly rejected. It just signaled that there was trouble on the horizon for the state. So you know, and generally when you hear a flurry of objections or you know requests for sidebar or break, something's not going good for the person that is asking for this type of relief.
Well, but one of the things that I saw was that even you know with regards to all of that, his supervisor or whatever said that regardless there was no need for him to have his knee on there or neck or on his neck or shoulder or whatever for the whole 9 minutes and 29 seconds. There was a point where it just wasn't necessary.
Yes, the chief. The chief came in, and the chief led things off, and the chief said that what took place was unethical, extreme, and that the measures went on too long. Now, let me just tell you that chiefs of police do not testify at trial. It's just something that is it's rare. I mean, those things do happen, especially where policies are debated. But typically you do not see the chief, him or herself, at
right.
a trial under oath giving testimony. That is a signal, and it tells the people beneath the chief that whatever the chief says, you better say, all right? If the boss disapproves, guess what? We disapprove, okay? Yeah, that's what's cooking there. That when they trotted him in there, you know, with, you know, the uniform on, four stars, the necktie, you know, to basically say, hey, what happened shouldn't have happened. And then everybody else came in after him. So,
right.
You know, and frankly, let me just tell you, you know, a chief of police can impact the assignments that are given to subordinates. The chief can impact promotions. And also appraisals. You do not want to disagree with the chief in a nationally televised case. So if you think that one of those officers was going to walk in there and say, you know, chief is all wrong. He's wrong. You know, everything he's saying is like, you know, totally contradictory to policies. And I think what happened was reasonable. You know, and I happen to disagree. That was not going to happen. So, you know, that
right.
sets the tone. And then also there's that eye candy, you know, the average person catching a snippet of the case. You know, only people like you and me are glued to the set, man. You know, they see the chief sitting there, you know, in all his glory, and people are going to think, well, wow, this must be a big deal. The chief said it was wrong, so it's wrong.
Right.
You know, so, mm-hmm. yep.
Yeah. We're going to take our first break. We are here with civil rights attorney Kevin Anderson of Anderson & Welch in southeast central Florida. This is Geek Power Hour. I never had it so good entertainment. If you have questions, the number is 516-387-1944. Geek Power Hour. I never had it so good networks. We'll be right back.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Having a wedding, reception, family reunion, planning a banquet, or some other fundraising event. Need to share your knowledge through a workshop or seminar. Or it's a difficult time and you need to plan a wake or repast. Let us help. At our gatherings, let us reduce the stress and make the occasion memorable, treasured. Call our gatherings at 407-968-9387 or email ourgatherings@yahoo.com. Let us help plan your special event.
Hi, welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. The number is 516-387-1944. If you'd like to comment or ask questions of civil rights attorney Kevin Anderson regarding the Derek Chauvin trial. But I want to ask you, or, well, I guess speculate a little bit. I suspect that this trial and the fact that we have the chief police in this city and, you know, others in blue testifying against someone that they worked with, I suspect there's going to be some conflict down the road. I suspect there's going to be some police union upheaval. Can you speculate on that? Can you talk about what your thoughts are about that?
No, I think everything's going to be business as usual. I think that there's probably going to be some adjustments. Yeah, there'll be some policy adjustments to reflect lessons learned from the trial and, you know, from listening to people like me and the other analysts who are evaluating what's taking place. I don't think that the unions are going to get up in arms about going after Derek Chauvin. For the most part, police officers are not backing what he did. Yeah, you know, he gave the police culture a black eye, and he's put them in an unfavorable light. He's made things difficult for law enforcement. So I think, you know, for the most part, I don't really see a whole lot of changes at a police union level. But then again, I've never represented unions, and I really have not been on that side of the house. So I don't know what makes them tick. I just know that they put a lot of money into defending officers when I sue them. That's about it.
Okay. And then what do you suspect is going to be tweaked about policy and from after this trial and going into the future, or what do you see that has been tweaked so far since this whole situation began?
Stay away from the neck. No neck. No. Yeah. You know, these neck restraints, these holds that, you know, will make one black out, you know, making them unconscious or something. Stay away from the neck. No neck action, guys. All right.
But they've had a few, haven't they, since then?
Sure. That was a recognized maneuver, actually, with the department. There were maneuvers that were authorized by Minneapolis. Which would cause a person to lose consciousness. They literally had that in their use of force policy. There are things that that are done for that purpose. And I think that, you know, anytime you have a non-medical person causing a human being to lose consciousness because you are restricting the flow of blood and therefore the oxygen that gets to the tissues and the brain, you got trouble. You know, these police officers aren't practitioners. They aren't medical practitioners. They're out in the field. They're like warriors at that point when you're fighting somebody, you know, and for them to decide, you know, it's time, you know, for you to go night-night, lights out, you know, it is not a good thing. So I think we're going to have officers staying away from the neck, the throat. I think that's just going to be taken out of policies, and I think they're going to clear the way so that officers are now on their own. That if you start, you know, choking people out or, you know, putting your knees on, you know, the back of a vertebrae or across the windpipe, that like, man, you know what, if you get sued, you're on your own, baby. We're not even going to, like, you know, kind of indemnify. We're just going to let you do your thing, and we're going to fire you because, you know, it's just too costly. This costs a lot of money, man, for Minneapolis. A lot of money. So
yeah,
that's what I foresee.
I wasn't just thinking about Minneapolis, though. I was thinking that there would have been some others since then, too. But also, and by the way, while we're on, I kind of came across this thing from the United States Department of Justice. There's an article from the National Institute of Corrections. I just posted on G's Power Hour Facebook page about civil liability for the use of neck restraints. So it might be an interesting read if anybody's interested, but it's a two-part article. But one of the things I saw when I was looking over some stuff where somebody said, when it's applied, I guess, properly, so to speak, it really only takes about 10 seconds for a person to go unconscious with a properly applied neck restraint, which leads me to wonder if, you know, even with the training, if this was not necessarily applied properly, because if he would have been out in 10 seconds, then he would have been maybe former officer Chauvin would have been allowed to, I guess, relax his hold on Mr. Floyd.
Yes, true. I think I saw that article that you were talking about, but I know, I think the article was influenced by this case. It was a Supreme Court decision of City of Los Angeles versus Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S,
mm-hmm.
where they kind of go into, you know what, you know, what happens during, you know, a neck restraint and, you know, when one may or may not utilize the restraint. But, you know, they're dangerous. They're dangerous. You know, it's like a time bomb. You know, yes, you can, you know, you can deactivate, like, some of them. But every
mm-hmm.
now and then, you know, you're going to have an explosion and somebody's going to get hurt.
Right.
Can we figure out a better way to take people into custody without grabbing their throats and, putting pressure on one's vertebrae or, you know, I mean, we have handcuffs, they're generally outnumbered. You know, you've got, you know, a number of restraint devices, tasers, you know, really, do we have to go for the throat? Or as they say, do you need to go for the jugular? I think we can do a little better when we're out in the field there.
Well,
were talking about reasonableness, subjective reasonableness.
Uh-huh.
And this kind of is a good segue, you know. They were talking about you heard them talking about the Graham versus Connor standard. Do you recall them talking about that, you know, and what's reasonable and what isn't reasonable and consistent with Graham? And I've had so many people ask me, what's going on with the Graham thing? What do they mean by that? You know, and you're going to hear more and more of it because Graham is the seminal, and I'm not talking about Seminole County. All right. I'm talking
mm-hmm.
about one of the leading cases regarding the use of force by law enforcement. And it was a Supreme Court case that had remarkably similar features as the George Floyd case. And that case involved a fella who was a diabetic who went into
mm-hmm.
a convenience store. He went into a convenience store. And while he was in a convenience store, he just he could not wait any longer. So he went back to his vehicle and drove away. And as he was being driven, the police saw him leave hurriedly from the convenience store, so they executed a traffic stop. During the stop, the fellow got out of the car, and the police subdued him. They put him in handcuffs. They laid him prone, and he complained that he was having a diabetic reaction and that he needed insulin and he needed, you know, them to just kind of ease up on him some. And they didn't listen, you know, with all kinds of expletives and activity. They sort of ignored him. And even his friend tried to come to his aid while he was there in cuffs and prone to hand him juice, you know, to kind of bring him back around. And the police, you know, would not allow anyone to help him. So he lived, okay, but not, you know, before he sustained, you know, some physical injury. I think he had a broken foot and some bruises and things like that. But ultimately the Supreme Court ruled that the objective reasonableness of the officer's activity is what we use and not the subjective intent of the officer to determine whether the force that's being used is appropriate. And that, you know, they have to look at things like the severity of the crime when the force is applied, the threat against the officers, and whether the person is actually resisting arrest or trying to escape. So that's the standard that is being referred to when you hear them talking about the, quote, Graham standard, unquote.
Okay. So what other things were, I guess, of most note? Oh, by the way, that Graham versus Connor, I did find that, also posted on G's Power Hour Facebook page, you guys, to look at. What other things did you find of most note since we spoke last week?
Maurice Hall. Can we talk about Mr. Hall, who was in the car with Mr. Floyd?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, we had Mr. Floyd's girlfriend, I believe, last week.
Right.
Who gave trial testimony that drugs were purchased from Mr. Hall about a week or so prior to the Mr. Floyd being killed. Okay, so now enter Maurice Hall, who unceremoniously was brought in by Zoom in the county jail, who pleaded he didn't plead the Fifth, but he intends to assert the Fifth Amendment to prevent him from testifying in the case because he is of the belief that because Mr. Floyd died and because there is an assertion that the death might be attributed to drug ingestion, that he too could be charged with murder and maybe even for selling or providing the drugs to Mr. Floyd. So therefore, there was a motion to prevent his testimony and maybe in the alternative to streamline what he would be asked. So the judge in the case asked the parties to submit questions, and the judge would look at these questions in camera. What in camera means is that the court will take these things under advisement alone and then will return with a decision with respect to whether the witness testifies and, if so, what those limitations would consist of during the testimony. So what struck me was that the prosecution could have avoided all of that by giving this man immunity. They do not intend to give him immunity. Immunity would require that witness to come forward and to testify. And I thought, well, why? Why would you not give this guy immunity? You give everybody else immunity? Like, what's the problem? Like, this would be huge, you know, for him to come into that courtroom and to talk about what was happening in the car. Because I think the facts show that even though there was some interest in calling the police on Mr. Floyd and the occupants of the vehicle on the date that died, that he did not move the vehicle because he felt asleep and that they could not wake him up and that there might be some reason why he could not be awakened. So I would think that, you know, perhaps somebody would be interested in knowing, well, what the heck was going on in that car, man? Well, I mean, I think this suggests that perhaps immunity wasn't granted
because
the
prosecution doesn't
want
to know.
No, they don't want you to know. They don't want you to know the truth. He might come in and tell the truth. What do you think about that? I mean, you know, God forbid we get the truth. But on the other hand, I think this signals that there might not be full transparency in the particular case. That, man, everything's cool, you know, as long as the gamesmanship goes in your direction. But when it doesn't, then you're going to obstruct a little. But I mean, that's what I'm seeing. You know, I wanted to hear from him, and I still do want to hear from the guy. You know, I think he's got something to say that's worthwhile. So that has happened. So
well,
what
do you think is the worst that he could say that could
be the worst he could say that could
shed negative light on the prosecution?
He could say that, you know, we knew that, you know, the police were coming and that we saw them. We managed to wake him up when we, you know, finally knew that, like, they were there. And he grabbed a handful of pills and shoved them in his mouth, man, to prevent being taken to jail for, you know, possession of meth and fentanyl, speedballs. That is probably the worst. So that prior to going to the store, you know, we all engaged in drug use. And, you know, he was already, like, on the way out. He was nodding out before we even got to, got back out the store or something, you know, something like that. Nodding out for, you know, the nerds in the crowd here means falling asleep. Right. So, yeah, I think that's the worst that he could say, you know. We probably won't hear much from him. All right. We probably won't hear much from him. So, what else? Let's see. Oh, let's talk about the doctor.
Let's talk about the doctor when we come back. Okay.
Okay.
We're
going to
take a break. We're here with Kevin Anderson, civil rights attorney, talking about the Derek Chauvin trial. This is Dee's Power Hour. I've never had it so good entertainment. The number is 516-387-1944 if you have questions or comments. Dee's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. We'll be right back.
This is Douglas Dobbs of Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community for 29 years with quality funeral and cremation services. Honoring all religions and faiths, we have been here for many grieving families. Whether it's a complete funeral service with a burial or a simple, dignified cremation, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here for you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs, dedicated to serving our families.
Hi, I'm Tim Garris. You may know me as Timmy G. Yeah, I know. It's been 2 decades, but I want you to know I'm back in the Arglicon. And I've got a mix of music that can help you relax and chill out. It's smooth. It's relaxing. It's chill out jazz. The soulful mix of smooth jazz, soul, and smooth R&B. So join me every Wednesday night, 10 p.m. to midnight, on K-Ham Radio.
Are you chillin'?
Good afternoon. Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Network. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. And we are talking about the Derek Chauvin trial, which is in the middle of a very short break right now, but should be back soon. And before we went to break, Attorney Kevin Anderson, civil rights attorney Kevin Anderson, was saying, let's talk about the doctor. So let's talk about the doctor. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I was surprised to see or to hear that the physician was still in residency and just sort of had this land in his lap. He actually was licensed, I think, in May of last year, the same month that Mr. Floyd was pronounced dead. And, he came in, and I thought he was very articulate, and I thought he was knowledgeable. I actually liked his testimony, but I thought it was the most important testimony that we've heard so far. So he said that when Mr. Floyd was brought to him, that he was already undergoing cardiac arrest. That is the sudden cessation of blood to the body tissue, and that he was in a state that he noted as PEA, pulseless electrical activity. In other words, there was no pulse, but electrical activity was detected, and that he had begun to flatline because there was no cardiac activity, and that he determined that there were a number of things that could have resulted in this condition that he had to rule out, but one that more likely than not was the reason for this condition was something known as hypoxia, which is where there is a deficient amount of oxygen that reaches the tissues, and that the hypoxia was caused by asphyxia. Now, what was not clear was the reason for the asphyxiation. And there were multiple causes that were talked about during the direct examination and also talked about during cross-examination. And for what I was able to pull out of the testimony, that you've got a couple of things that would cause a person to be asphyxiated. And one would be, for example, where an individual aspirates, meaning an obstruction in the airways. Another would be because of suffocation, which would be where you would cover or obstruct the airway and therefore the oxygen supply. A third would be strangulation. That would be choking. The theory essentially that the state is trying to present as the primary and actually the exclusive cause of the death in this particular case. And finally, because of things like drug overdoses, which would cause like a mechanical or a physical asphyxiation because the organs are no longer reacting and therefore not able to supply oxygen to the body because of abnormal breathing resulting from the drug ingestion. We talked about something also called excited delirium, that that could also impact a person's ability to function properly and therefore not breathe, which would and could result in hypoxia. But the million-dollar question was not asked. And that is to apply the mechanics of medicine to the actual facts in the case and to tell us how he died based upon the facts that he saw. So he was kind of concluding the medical reason why he died, but not how, though. What I brought or what I take away from that is that this was kind of a light probe. This was sort of the scout that you send out ahead of the troops to see if he's going to get shot, to kind of draw fire to see where the snipers are. Because this witness was taken out of turn. This witness is certainly not the only medical witness who will testify. And I think that the state put him out there to kind of see, what the defense was going to do. And based on the defense's cross-examination and the jury's reaction, they're reloading and getting the other witnesses prepared. I think also this witness's testimony is potentially dangerous and bad. So you want to get that guy up front and get him out there so that, by the time we get, further down the line, the jury would have forgotten about this guy or so much would have happened until his testimony would be sufficiently neutralized. There is a reason why he was brought forward so quickly up front in the case in chief presented by the state. Oh, great. Great. There was a bit of silence there. I thought.
No, I accidentally hit hit the mute button with my chin. Okay. Something that has been weighing on me, it has nothing to do with the medical stuff, but it's more about this argument about the crowd and crowd interference and crowd distraction. Now, aren't you, if you are a police officer, trained to have to, I guess I would say, compartmentalize to deal with the task at hand, regardless of what the situation is? And then also, too, there are, or were, I guess my understanding was, four other officers that were, you know, managing the crowd that probably would have called in other people to help manage the crowd while you got your knee on Mr. Floyd's neck. How much really is the crowd a part of, you know, being able to focus on the job? Is there some real concern? I mean, it didn't seem to me in this particular case that there was a lot of concern. There wasn't any throwing of anything, from what I understand. There was just a lot of, you know, please get this man some help type of thing, you know, yelling and, you know, you guys or whatever, which I'm sure the police get all the time, you know. Can you talk a little bit about what that crowd impact really has and whether or not it's going to play a role in this case?
Well, the officer who I think she testified last yesterday, Officer McKenzie, the EMT and medical support officer, whose job is to teach the patrol officers in the field how to deal with medical emergencies, she talked about the crowd. And she said that that the crowd is a sincere and real distraction, which would harm the application of medical measures. And she gave like three reasons. She said that in order to administer some type of assistance, you have to focus on the particular person who is in custody. You have to keep your head down, so to speak, while you work. Well, you can't keep your head down while you're trying to, you know, make sure a Coke bottle isn't being hurled at you, or a martial artist isn't, you know, jetting off the curb to give you a roundhouse to the temple or something. Second, she said that one has to be able to properly assess the condition of the detainee, and that requires concentration, and that requires also the ability to not have these this divided attention between the crowd and your safety and the person who might need the attention that you might otherwise be able to provide. And then finally, she said that signs of distress are often salient, and that, you know, you might miss these signs if, like, you're glancing up and you're glancing down, you're glancing up and you're glancing down. So therefore, you know, crowd control would be a big deal, and crowd management a big deal with respect to the application of life-sustaining measures. I found her testimony to be credible. I mean, she could have just come in and said, it's not really big. We train them on how to overcome that, but she didn't. Also, Johnny Mercio, the use of force instructor, he came in and he said that the crowd could cause things to ramp up pretty quickly. And that's another reason why you kind of want to hold the person in place, because, literally, if the crowd wanted to, the crowd could overtake you. And so you kind of want this person that you have in custody to lay without the ability to hype them up or to do things that could make this thing turn into a more of a problem than it really is at the moment. So, but I hear you. I mean, I saw the crowd, and they didn't look that that aggressive or that harmful.
It didn't at all. I kept hearing, the crowd was larger than we thought. You know, there were more people than we thought. It was like, that really wasn't that big of a crowd from what I saw. You know, I wasn't there, and I don't have all the angles, but. Yeah.
No, I didn't think so. I thought that the fella who testified earlier in the case who is a self-professed martial artist, he was the most mm-hmm. aggressive because I think at one point the fella from the store who complained about the counterfeit $20 bill tried to hold him back. I don't know whether you saw that or not. He kind of held him back.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, you know, one of the defendant officers in the case, he agitated the crowd. He kind of pushed somebody. He put his hands mm-hmm. on people, and he was like, you know, pushing them back on the curb. So, you know, I mean, I could see him like, you know, kind of walking towards them, but he placed his hands on people. And, you know, if you don't want people to, you know, fight you or to get irritated,
right.
keep your hands off of them.
Don't like when you put your hands on them uninvited, no matter what the circumstance is.
I agree.
Yeah.
Holy.
So when it's that kind of tense, no touching. Wow. All right. We're going to take our last break. We are here with Attorney Kevin Anderson. This is in regards to the Derek Chauvin trial going on right now for the murder of George Floyd, accused of the murder of George Floyd. This is G's Power Hour. I never had so good entertainment. If you have questions, the number is 516-387-1944. G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Tim Garris. And I think I found a way to help you understand what is Chill Out Jazz.
Some of y'all may be confused because of the style we choose. We make jazz and R&B. We don't categorize. We just make what sound good, baby. Is it jazz?
It is what it is.
Is it R&B?
Tune in every Wednesday night at 10 on KHAM Radio.
This is Douglas Dobbs, owner and funeral director at Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service. We have served the Central Florida community with two generations of family funeral service. With the recent addition of my son Brandon, we are here to take care of the needs of Central and West Orlando. From simple cremation to a full burial, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service is here to help you. Located at 430 North Kirkman Road at the 408 Expressway, Dobbs Cremation and Funeral Service, 407-578-7720. Dobbs, dedicated to serving our families.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to G's Power Hour. I've never had it so good entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. 407 Day here in Central Florida. Please go and support a local businesses, shop or eat or whatever you need to do. You know, get your hair cut, get your hair done, whatever you need to do. And be safe doing it, but please go out and support a local business today. Anyway, we are back talking about the Derek Chauvin trial with civil rights attorney Kevin Anderson of Anderson & Welsh. The number, if you have questions in the last few minutes, is 516-387-1944. That's 516-387-1944. I wanted to ask you, it seems like the trial is moving along at a pretty decent clip. And I know there is some speculation that was going to take approximately, you know, 4 weeks or so. Do you think that long, or do you think we're going to round the curve and see the end soon?
I think it's going to take longer than 4 weeks. We're in the second week and still in what is known as the state's case in chief. Don't forget that there is going to be, at the close of the state's case in chief, what is known as a motion for a judgment of acquittal, which is where the defense gets to challenge whether the state has proven the elements of each and every charged crime. Those motions in normal settings, kind of, when I say normal, not televised and not these cases that are just kind of pumped up because of the world's focus on them. The average case with a judgment of acquittal will have about 5 minutes of argument and maybe a half hour at the most before the judge rules right from the bench. In this particular case, I suspect that the judge will take those arguments fully and then he'll leave with them under advisement, and then he may or may not issue a written decision with respect to the denial or the granting of the motion. So you got that. Then the defense has a chance now. They get to present evidence. the defense gets to go on and to put on witnesses and different evidence that's not confined to the scope of the government's evidence. You know, there's something right now called the scope of examination, and the defense is limited in what they can do based on what the state throws their way. So they have to kind of weave in within the narrow confines of the state's theory during the state's portion of the case. When the tides turn, that is when the defense is able to put its own witnesses up, put its own evidence out there, and now the state will be responding to the defense. So you have that. So I think that those procedural steps alone will cause this case to go well beyond 4 weeks, notwithstanding the closing arguments in the particular case. And, you know, the state, the judge commented on the cumulative nature of the witnesses in that, like, hey, you're bringing in the same people. You're bringing in different people to say the same thing. Like, how many times are we going to hear, you know, the same argument? So the state, I think, is kind of prolonging things. And have you noticed, G, the number of witnesses, I'm sorry, the number of prosecutors that are, you know, kind of showing up from day to day? And and Nelson is there like by himself. It reminds me of like a Bruce Lee movie or something where you got all these guys like showing up, you know, circling him, and you know, he's like, oh my God. You know, you're thinking like, okay, you got one guy doing the medical, one guy doing the trainers, another guy doing the fact witnesses, and then, you know, then and another woman doing other people. And it's the same defense lawyer kind of like doing, you know, fit to the fit every witness. So I mean, you know, and I'm thinking, do you have a team? Is there like, you know, is there an associate behind him kind of doing something? I'm not sure what her role is, but he does confer with her. But I'm thinking, all right, I mean, to be by himself, I think he's doing a pretty decent job. He's alone.
Right.
You know, for the most part. And, you know, and I know Chauvin, he's just, I don't know what he's over there doing. He's just writing stuff down. You know, I mean, I guess they're conferring with him at some point. But, yeah.
Yeah, I did notice that, and so I'm just like wondering, I guess, the strategy. Okay, you cover medical. Okay, you cover, you know, training, and you cover this, that, or the other. And I guess they have each of those people attempting to get proficient on that particular aspect of the case. That's my thinking. But do you think maybe there will be some other people that show up on the defense side when it is their turn?
It's doubtful. I think that, you know, you bring them in now, you know, to defend. When you're on the offense, you're running the show. So, you know, you kind of know everything that you're doing. You know, it's the defense of the case that requires, I think, the reinforcement. So, you know, I don't think so. I'd be surprised if these people show up then. That would be, you never know. You never know, but I'd be surprised. I'm probably going to do some research on Mr. Nelson to see, you know, what his background is, beyond the cursory research that I conducted on him at the beginning of the case itself to see, you know, what's going on. I don't believe he's a public defender or anything like that. Because if he were, there would be multiple defenders in that courtroom. You know, I've been a public defender, and I'll tell you what, a case like that, man, the crew would be there, I'm telling you.
Yeah. So how do you, if you were to, how do you keep score, so to speak, in a trial like this? If, you know, as far as it's gotten to this point, who I guess you could say are the scales of justice leaning more toward as we've gone so far?
I'll tell you, generally, if you still think you got a shot, if you're alive, if you're still alive as a defense lawyer, then you're having a pretty decent day. And, you know when you're getting massacred. Yeah, you know, I don't think he's that the defense has been destroyed. You know, I think that they've been hurt. They definitely have been hurt. You know, but I think, you know, I don't think there's anybody that could say, hey, look, man, you know, it's over. It's over. You know, I mean, if you listen to the Crump delegation, you know, the case should never have gone to trial. You know, I mean, that kind of thing. And, you know, he doesn't even deserve a trial, that kind of thing. But I think that there is a there's a fight taking place right now. And there are credible defenses that are being asserted. And I think the government is pursuing prosecutorial theories that are lethal, and they are scoring points. They always, when they start first, they win. It's just like, you know, looking at a football game. When you don't have the ball, you look like you're losing, you know. And, you know, it's four quarters that tells you what the score will consist of. So I'm watching it like everybody else. I'm not prepared to make a prediction, and I won't make a prediction. But I'll tell you that I think there is a genuine fight taking place in that courtroom.
Well, the interesting thing is that you would think, like you say, the defense doesn't look that beat up. I mean, you would think if there was going to be any beating to be done, they needed to, you know, come out almost immediately, I would think, even though we've got some more time left. You know, you don't want people, if you are, let's say, in favor of the prosecution, you don't want to, you know, people to feel like you just said that, they seem to be doing, you know, they seem to be standing pretty strong. You want to feel like you've just really kind of massacred them right about now, don't you?
You do. You do. And I think that the strength of the case will be with the pathologist. That is the strength of the case. And again, I think the probing, you know, the putting of that medical witness up first and out of turn was calculated in order to kind of see what the response would consist of and to kind of get him out the way, because he's probably the weaker of the witnesses, you know, in the case. Of the medical witnesses in the case. So I think they wanted to kind of put him out there first because, you know, he was just not the stronger medical witness. He basically was put on to say, hey, look, he's dead. You know, he was dead, you know, at a certain point when I got to him.
Because my thinking is, you know, once the defense takes over, then the prosecution is not going to have that much of an opportunity to hit back, per se. You know?
Well, they have rebuttal. So the state can do a rebuttal case. So they can, they literally, after they cross-examine in the defense's case in chief, the state attorney will have an opportunity to present rebuttal witnesses themselves. Mm-hmm. So they get that unique opportunity. It's kind of interesting, huh? You know, they get to come back, you know, and open up again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, well, what kind of, I know we got about a minute or so, what kind of rebuttal witnesses would those be when you're bringing people back after the defense is done? What would it be, some of the same people from before? Would you call them back? Would it be new people?
It could be the same, could be new, but the scope will be limited to rebuttal issues. And those issues, I'm just going to tell you, I think will be training and causation, medical causation.
Okay. Mr. Anderson, again, always a pleasure to hear your take on this, you know, to help us lay people kind of make a better assessment and get a better understanding of what's going on. So thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
And thank you all for listening. This has been G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Be well, be safe, be blessed, and please remember, all real power comes from God. Go support a local business. Take care.
He'll make it all right.
Yeah.
make it all right. Come on. Whatever you want.
Whatever you want.
God is able.
God is able.
Whatever you need.
Whatever you need.
He'll supply.
Whatever is broken,
he can fix it.
He can fix it.
No need to worry.
No need to worry.
He's alive.